can't tell if the chemistry's good by looking at it. It wasn't clear yesterday. For the last time, the saltwater pool is a chlorine pool.
This is the Talking Pools Podcast with pool pros from every region in the country. If it happens in a pool, you'll hear about it here. Everything from tips and hacks to the latest tricks and trends. Breaking news, we lay it on the line. We tell it like it is because we think you deserve to know.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to Talking Pools Tuesdays with Dan. Thanks for tuning in again today. Thought I'd follow up this week a little bit on some electrical stuff, seeing as how last week I talked about the National Electric Code and the things that everyone needs to consider when they're out there doing repairs, installations, so on and so forth. I thought I'd go into a little bit of a topic that Kelly and I had covered a little over a year ago and use it as a refresher for those of you that had listened back then, or if you're new to the show since we covered this a little bit over a year ago, maybe it'll help you out in some of the stuff you're working on out in the field. Try and make sure you're doing things right, doing things safe, and doing things professional.
Join the Council for the Model Aquatic Health Code, aka CMAC. CMAC is a member-driven organization that keeps the Model Aquatic Health Code sustainable, current, and complete. Your expertise is needed. Learn more at CMAC.org. That's CMAHC.org.
In some of the areas of electrical work that we've run into, seeing a lot of things done incorrectly is relative to wire size and amperage draw on the piece of equipment and circuit breakers. There are all kinds of, you know, you can Google this stuff. It's not that you can't find the information, but I think that all too often we have people just sort of going by what they either have on the truck or what they think they know, and it can lead to some problems. So different wire sizes, they're gauged in different sizes based on the diameter of the wire, based on the type of wire. So aluminum wire versus copper wire, et cetera. I can't remember the last time I've seen aluminum wire used anywhere in our market in the Chicago area, whether it's in the pool area or in homes or anything like that. But that was not uncommon many years ago to have aluminum wire. But today, pretty much everything we're dealing with is copper, either stranded or solid. Different reasons you might use one as opposed to another. Stranded wire is something you can use crimp on connectors, right? So if you want to put a spade on the end of a wire to make it easier to push on and off of a terminal, a female spade onto a male spade, you're going to want to use stranded wire to be able to crimp that and get a good crimped connector. That crimping crushes into the wire strands themselves and get you a real solid connection that's going to last for a long, long time. You really can't crimp solid copper wire. If you're dealing with solid copper wire, you're using that for other applications. Maybe you're wrapping it around a terminal screw, inserting it into a circuit that has a screw that'll compress down onto it, something along that lines, but you're not putting a crimp connector on a solid wire. The different gauges of wire, it's sort of a reverse of what some may think without knowing much about wire, in that as the number of the gauge goes down, the amount of amperage that wire can handle goes up. And for most everything we deal with should be 12-gauge wire. And the reason for that is 12-gauge wire will handle up to 20 amps. And most everything that we deal with is around that 20 amp level on the residential side anyway. Variable speed pumps commonly are drawing 14, 16 amps, something like that. 17, 18 amps, no, not so much. More around 16, I would say, maybe 17. But the 12-gauge wire with the 20-amp max is going to work out real well for that. Other components that we use, you're not going to be wrong by using 12-gauge wire. So a gas heater with electronic ignition. Honestly, that heater's drawn less than 5 amps typically, probably even lower than that, way lower down to 1 or 2 amps. Running a 12-gauge wire that can handle 20 amps, you're never going to run into problems. So if you use a wire that's too small of a gauge relative to the amperage draw that it's applied to, what you'll end up having happen is that wire is going to get hot because it can't handle the flow of electrons through it, and it's going to superheat, and that's where you get into issues that you can actually cause a fire. The wire, the casing on a wire can melt, depending on what the wire is encapsulated in. If it's a PVC conduit, there could be issues there. So we want to make sure that we're using a wire that's properly sized to the application. And with that too, you want to consider leaving basically a 10% variance. So if you're running a 12-gauge wire that should handle 20 amps, we really don't want to have it maxed out at 20 amps continually. We want to have at least a 10% variation. So you're really maxing out at a continuous run of around 18. So you never push things to their limits is really the bottom line. But in terms of gauge, 14-gauge wire can handle 15 amps. Again, as a gauge goes down, the amperage goes up. 12-gauge wire can handle 20 amps. 10-gauge can handle up to 30 amps. 8-gauge can handle 40 amps. And, you know, if you go to 6-gauge, you're getting up in the 55-amp range and so on. So in a lot of homes today, most of the circuits in the house are on 15-amp circuit breakers for outlets, maybe lighting, low-demand, low-amperage applications. And in those homes, there's 14-gauge wire run. 14-gauge wire is going to be less expensive than 12, which is less than 10, and so on. Obviously, less copper that's involved in the diameter, the more reasonably priced the product is. So if you're feeding outlets in a room that really are never anticipated to need more than 15 amps, why go through spending the money to run 12-gauge to put a 20-amp circuit in? Builders often will have the electricians run 14-gauge wire for 15-amp circuits. And same thing for lighting, especially today with LED lighting. Excuse me, in homes, same sort of a thing. The LED lighting, obviously, very, very low amperage, so they can put a lot of lights on a 15-amp circuit and not have to worry about spending the extra money or overloading the circuit. But again, for our application, most of what we're dealing with in terms of pumps, specifically residentially, 12-gauge, 20-amp circuits are what we're wanting to do. Now, as we talk about the circuit breaker and the wire size, you always need to make sure that a wire, that the ampacity of a wire exceeds the rating of the circuit breaker. So I can put a 12-gauge wire that has the capacity of handling 20 amps onto a 15-amp breaker. That breaker is going to trip when the amperage draw exceeds 15 amps, and the wire is capable of handling 20. The wire is never going to be compromised because of the heat of the circuit drawing more than what it's able to do. The contrary to that, though, is a problem, and this is where we see things done wrong out in the field frequently. You can't put a 14-gauge wire, or you shouldn't, rather, a 14-gauge wire onto a 20-amp circuit breaker. So the 20-amp circuit breaker is going to let the power go until it exceeds 20 amps. The 14-gauge wires can only handle 15 amps. So if that wire, for whatever reason, starts exceeding the ampacity of the wire itself, it gets into 16, 17, 18, 19 amps, the wire starts to get hot. The breaker hasn't hit its limit, so it's not going to trip. And you're going to potentially have an issue with, like I said, a fire. The wire is going to be compromised, things like that. The other issue with that is that the actual power at the end of the wire or the voltage as that amperage goes up and exceeds the wire's ampacity, the voltage is going to decrease, which means you're not getting the device, the equipment, the pump, whatever it is, to run under the voltage that it was designed for. And there too, there's a 10% fluctuation that if something is designed to run 230 volts, it's designed with a plus or minus factor in that. So, you know, if you're 230 volts and you're getting 207, 208 volts to it, that's acceptable because it's within that 10% range. If you drop more than 10%, that's where you're getting into brownout type of situations. Power companies often where power is not very consistent and stable in the areas of the country will forcibly run in brownouts because they don't have enough capacity to provide the full voltage to everybody. And you may have areas where they tell you, hey, turn off all of your air conditioning or your high draw items. Those are the items that tend to be affected faster by voltages being run at a low voltage situation. High voltage, same thing. You don't want to have it exceeding a plus 10%. So, you know, what's that? 230, you're looking at 243 volts basically at 10% over. No, 253 volts maybe if I'm doing the math right. Yeah, 253. 230 to 253. If you're getting up in the 254, 255, 260 range, there's something really weird going on. Brownout's much more common than surges, but anything can happen. So wires, wire size, breaker size, heat pumps. So heat pumps commonly are running on a, you know, like a 50 amp breaker. And most heat pumps are going to need to have a 6-gauge wire run to them. And we see frequently long runs of 8-gauge, or I've even seen 10-gauge wire used to try to power up a heat pump. And when a heat pump's brand new, probably run fine. The heat pumps, you know, tends to be when things are not installed properly, when they're brand new out the gate, they'll work for a period of time. But it doesn't take long before all of a sudden it's not working. And inevitably you go out there, and if you identify that as a problem, well, homeowners commonly will say, oh, well, this has been running for, you know, 3 months this way, haven't had a problem. That can't be it. Now, that is it. And you should never leave something running when you know that it's installed in a way that can be damaging or dangerous. So you want to shut that thing off. Hopefully everyone's carrying some sort of lockout tags and noting it both verbally in writing, taking pictures of it, disabling things even. That's what we instruct our technicians to do. We get any kind of a piece of equipment that is potentially harmful, we're going to disable that thing. We're going to disconnect power. We're going to literally pull the wires off of it or some means completely disable it. So the layperson can't just simply go turn a switch back on and let it run. And, you know, we've certainly had people not real happy with us doing that and yelling and screaming and threatening to sue us and all the rest of that stuff. But I'll deal with that as opposed to someone being hurt or something burning down as a result of our negligence of not identifying that when we're out there.
Tune in next Tuesday for the shocking conclusion to Pool Pros Gone Wire.
Just wanted to take a minute to say thank you for listening today. I'm hoping you enjoyed the episode as much as we enjoyed putting it together for you. Listen, it's been a couple of wacky, crazy, screwed up years from pandemic to Poolmageddon. I just want you to know that we are all in this together. If there's anything that we can do for you, send me an email at talkingpools@gmail.com. Again, that's talkingpools@gmail.com. We're here. This is your podcast. We are the Pool People's Podcast, of the pool people, for the pool people, by the pool people's podcast. This one is about you. So thank you for tuning in and listening. Do me a favor, click subscribe before you go. That way you don't miss an episode.